social scientists conducted an interesting study to find out how much communication was going on between middle-class fathers and their young children. The first part of the survey was interviewing the fathers to ask them to estimate the amount of time that there was direct communication between father and child in the average day. And the fathers estimated on average 15 to 20 minutes. This social scientist then did something that showed a certain measure of bravery all by itself in attaching microphones to these young children and then taping the time when the fathers were in the homes and later measuring in time how long the actual communication took place. The average was not the 15 to 20 minutes that the fathers had estimated, but the average was 37 seconds per day. Now, family communication is not something easy to do. We live very busy schedules. If anything, I suppose that social historians will comment on our generation and our time, indicating that they were extraordinarily busy days, that our lives were too full and we had too many commitments. At the same time, probably most of us are not particularly skilled in terms of communication. We often operate with false assumptions, and often poor communications are not really diagnosed until a marriage or a family is really in serious difficulty, sometimes perhaps so serious difficulty that the problems are difficult, if not impossible, to resolve. And yet, at the same time, the question is not whether we will have communication or not. The question is the quality that that communication will have. For even when people are not speaking to each other, they communicate. If I come up here tonight and fold my arms and look at you and don't say a thing, after a while that will communicate something, and you in turn will start communicating to me. In fact, even in those few seconds, I saw certain levels of discomfort, wondering how long I would carry it on. And the same thing is true in families. Even when not a word is spoken, even when people don't see each other, they are clearly communicating all kinds of messages back and forth. We communicate with facial expressions. We communicate with body gestures. When we do speak, it's not just the words that we say, but it's also the inflections that come with the words. That means, then, that much of family communication is not, in fact, factual, but is largely emotional, that we are communicating much of how we feel. And so our focus must be on what the inevitable communication that will take place, what really there transpires. This has always been a problem even between us and God. God has communicated to humankind for all of history, and often we have not listened. The people of Israel in ancient times often did not listen to that which God spoke to them. And so again and again in the Bible, it's a fascinating study all by itself, God says, listen to me. Listen. Hear what I have to say. When good communication does take place, it's marvelous. It's just a wonderful thing to behold. Whether it is between us and God or between members of the family. One husband tells the story of what happened to him in his marriage, and it's worth a direct quote. I thought about paraphrasing this, and I thought he said it so well, I'd better give you his exact words. He said, I grew up in a large family. Nobody had much time to listen to anybody else. When I was married, I was astonished that when I said something, my wife looked directly at me, listened to me, even encouraged me with a question, a smile, or a comment. You have no idea what a feeling of importance that gave me. She tells me, without putting it in words, that she's interested in what I have to say. How wonderful. How wonderful that someone could come out of a family context in which he felt he was never heard and enter into a marriage with a woman who, by all that she said and did and the way she looked and responded, said, I'm hearing you. And his sense of self-worth and self-esteem simply soared. Well, tonight, I would like us to give most of our time to positive things that we can do in terms of family communication, but Maybe it's helpful to take a look at a quick list of causes of broken family communication, a list that I do not claim to be original. It actually comes from some authors named Wade and Jody Rowett, who have written on the causes of broken communication. I'm sure the list could be much longer, but they list four causes. The first, they say, is unresolved anger. And the issue is not so much anger that we have it, but the issue is how we handle the anger that we have. Sometimes that anger, and particularly in families, is deep-rooted and is long-lived. In other cases, it's brief, but can be very, very troublesome. When anger is not resolved, it starts to crop up here and there in totally unexpected places, sometimes places quite seemingly unrelated to the original source and cause of that anger. Often others in the family have no idea what's really behind what's being said or done, and it's that outcropping of anger that has been unresolved. A second cause of broken communication listed by the Rowetts is chronic busyness, and I think again that that has got to be listed as one of the marks of our generation, where family members have become so engrossed with their jobs and their hobbies and their churches that they really don't have time for one another. We know that you can't grow a garden with neglect, but you also really can't grow relationships with neglect. Time has got to be put in, energy, resources. I think that families may get by in a temporary crisis of busyness if usually the structures are there and usually the communication is good. But if it's a chronic thing, if we are so busy and so involved in other things in other people's lives that we really don't have the time to communicate with one another, then when some other crisis comes along, there really will not be the resources to handle that crisis. And so the time to resolve the busyness problem is before the crisis arrives. A third cause for broken communication listed by the Rowetts is emotional overload, where one or more persons in the family is struggling with depression or anxiety or fear or some other major emotional issue. And that person then, because of that emotional overload, turns inward and sometimes cuts off all communication, or at least attempts to. We can then become so preoccupied with ourselves and our own needs that we really fail to adequately give all that needs to be given to adequately communicate with one another. And a fourth cause of broken communication that they list is developing entirely different activities and friends, where within a family, with a husband and wife, or parents and children, or any combination, individuals start going and growing in very different directions, so that homes become only places to sleep and to eat, or in many families, not even often eating meals together, until the common ground that families and couples have begin quickly to erode, and there becomes then very little basis for there to be communication. But tonight I think we're more interested in what we can do to prevent or to resolve the crisis of broken family communication. And first on the list, I think, ought be respect. I'm absolutely convinced that this is one of, if not the major factor in all good family communication. We've got to exhibit respect for the other person, who he or she is, and what is said, and what is communicated. I think that's particularly evident in Ephesians 5 and 6, which speaks often of the relationships that take place within families and within homes. Just listen to some examples. In Ephesians 5:21, we're told to be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. I suppose we might substitute there out of respect for Christ. So the idea is that as we reverence Jesus Christ and as we respect him, so we are to carry over that reverence and respect into the relationships that we have within our homes and within our families, which is what Ephesians chapter 5 is about. Verse 25 speaks specifically to husbands, to love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Now, respect generates love. In fact, I really don't think that the two ought or can ever be separated. Or in verse 22, that wives be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. Well, that type of submission requires respect. Maybe it shows up even more in chapter 6, where we're told that children are to honor father and mother. what other notion is that, but respect. Respect for parents, even when parents may do things that are not good and are out of line. Or in Ephesians 6:2, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. In other words, always treat children with respect, whether they are grown children or they are very young children. Provoking them to anger is really the fruit of treating children with disrespect for themselves as persons. Now, we communicate very, very differently with those whom we respect. I see that in myself. Sometimes I see things in myself that I don't particularly like. And I see that also in the way people treat me. To use the analogy in at least that direction, I find that someone may talk to me on the telephone or come up to me in conversation or that we may have an appointment together. And while I don't know that I often think about it, I'm sure that I can tell, as you can tell, within the first few moments of conversation, whether that individual treats me with respect as a person. And there are those who treat me disrespectfully, and there are those who treat me respectfully. And I'll tell you that those who treat me with respect, my integrity as a person, who honor me for who I am, those are people from whom I can take, I think, some of the most severe of criticism. And yet when people come and put me down or treat me condescendingly, I find that very quickly I become defensive. And I know that I trigger those same responses in other people. That then calls upon me to treat everybody with that kind of respect or reverence that I would have for Jesus Christ, for everyone, everybody is created in that image of God. Last Monday, maybe you read the Star and Tribune in the Variety section, an article about how to talk to your teenager. And there's a quote in there from Pauline Laburn, who's a social worker at Anthony Junior High in Minneapolis. Pauline says, one thing is necessary, one thing, most important of all in parents' communication with teenagers. Absolute respect for the teenager's feelings, whatever the issue is, whether it is drugs, sex, the world of academics. Without that respect, there is no building on any relationship or any impact on your child's attitude. If you want to see this in real life, go to any shopping center or out to the airport and just take a seat and listen and watch the way families interact. And you can tell very briefly whether or not there is mutual respect within that family. In the worst case examples, you will see parents who will talk to their children in the most demeaning and degrading fashion, with every comment, with every action, and then turn to a complete stranger who is a clerk behind the counter. And the body language will switch back and forth, and the tone of voice will switch back and forth. Even though there's no continuing relationship with that stranger, that person is treated with dignity and with respect, where at the same time, the person whom we know as a member of the family or to whom a commitment has been made is treated with disrespect and in a degrading way. Now, I know that there's a potential objection to this. And the potential objection is, how am I supposed to respect her or him? How am I supposed to respect a spouse who drinks too much? Or how am I supposed to respect a spouse who is unfaithful in the marriage? Or how am I supposed to give respect to a teenager who skips school? Or how am I supposed to respect and treat with respect in tone of voice and in body language a youngster who is continually defiant in every single issue at home? How can I do that when the person has not earned my respect? When respect is earned, some would say, then I will speak and treat with respect. You see, that's not the Christian way. The Christian way is different. For we know that God treats us with respect even while we're sinners. As human beings, we have sinned against God and we have treated him most despicably. And yet he always treats us with respect and dignity. Even when we defy him, he speaks to us and communicates to us in a way that gives to us dignity and acknowledges personhood whether we behave accordingly or not. I think that's a real concern. It's a burden on my own heart, that our homes need to be the place where we will see the image of God, even in those who do not behave as they should. That our homes be places where we will treat people with respect, even if those persons are not Christians and do not behave as Christians. That we will treat persons with respect, even when those persons are toddlers and we are adults, or even when we are parents and they are teenagers, or when we've been married for a day or for a year or for the better part of a century. That those not be the determining factors on whether we treat other people with dignity and respect, but that we always do that because that is the Christian thing to do, as well as the best thing to do for our families. Respect. Second is to listen. Seems to be such a simple thing. I was just reading recently in the Old Testament in 2 Kings chapter 21. It's the story of God's great communication to his people of Judah. God says there in 2 Kings 21, verses 7 and 8, "In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not cause the feet of Israel to wander any more out of the land which I gave to their fathers, if only they will be careful to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them." In other words, God is offering wonderful things, tremendous truths and blessing. The next verse, 2 Kings 21:9, says, "But they did not listen. And King Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations had done whom the Lord destroyed before the people of Israel." Or else, in Mark chapter 9, do you recall the story of the Mount of Transfiguration where these disciples are up there on the top of the mountain with Jesus, and he is transfigured? We know that name because some churches have been given that name. Probably don't actually much think about what occurred there. But essentially, the veil that shielded the glory of God from view in the person of Jesus Christ was briefly pulled back. And those disciples saw the glory of God revealed. It was an extraordinary thing. And Jesus glowed with this glory. And then a voice came from heaven, the voice of God the Father, who said, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." As if they wouldn't listen. But apparently God knew that even in the very best of circumstances, we often don't listen. And God was concerned about that kind of communication. And so he sensationally called for Jesus to be listened to. Bruce Larson has a book that's titled Ask Me to Dance, and in it he tells the story of a church secretary who had a sign on her desk, and the sign said simply, "I love you enough to listen." Now, I'm not suggesting that in our homes we literally have such signs, nor that we necessarily say those things, but we ought be communicating to one another, "I love you enough to listen." Listening often means more than just words. It's a commitment to be sensitive to whatever is being communicated. So a husband comes home from work and comes into the house. His wife herself has spent the day at work and has gotten home just a little bit early and has had all kinds of things that needed to be done, including in that particular home, the preparation for dinner that night. He comes walking in the door and he says, "Did you call Smith Realty?" And she responds by saying, "Do you have any idea all that I've had to do today? I mean, how long your list is? You know, you could do some of these things yourself." And so the communication deteriorates. Now, I in no way want to excuse his behavior for coming in and treating her brusquely or inappropriately. But perhaps what she could have done is to have listened to the things not stated in the words, listened to the emotions that were there, For what he was not saying to her was that that day at work had been extraordinarily difficult. He had committed a blunder that he never thought he was capable of. He had risked and in all probability lost one of the biggest accounts that the company had. His boss was irate, and the chances were good that when he went back to work the next morning, he would lose his job. And that had to do with all kinds of things, of financial commitments that they have made, of dreams that they want to have fulfilled. All of these things are tied together, and he never speaks that. And that's not fair that he doesn't speak it, but he doesn't. And so she needs to listen more than to the words that are spoken, but to that which is behind them. You see, in a family, we need to be regularly asking, why is he or she so irritable? Or is this unacceptable behavior that is so troublesome to us something that is an unspoken problem or an unknown concern? Now, I think that such serious listening, where we are really trying to find out what that person is communicating through words and through expressions and through the whole combination of the communication channels, that is hard, hard work. It does not just happen. But there's some things that we can do, some practical suggestions on listening. We can, for example, before forming responses, ask some questions. Simple questions, but they all become routine questions. Before forming a response, saying, I'm not sure that I understand all that you're saying. Can you explain it to me more? So instead of just coming back and taking it at simple initial face value, giving the other person an opportunity to say something else, or saying something so simple as, can you give me an example? So here's something has been said, maybe one of those all or nothing or never type of statements, and say, well, could you tell me just what an example of that would be? Or can you tell me how you feel about this? Or what would you suggest that we do about the situation? But you know, even that can be said in two different tones of voice. You can say, what do you suggest we do about the situation? And you can say, what do you suggest we do about the situation? That we really try to hear out what the other person is saying and wants to say. And then that we give some feedback. You know, one of the things that's done in communications courses and counseling courses and things like that is to tell people when one person has said something, before the other person can give his or her reply, first state back what you think you heard. So if we were to practice this here tonight, I would have one person stand here and make a statement and then have someone else repeat it back. Now, I don't mean a word at a time, like for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. Not that type of statement, but someone has an opportunity to speak a paragraph or a page, and then the other person says, well, here's what I heard you say. Sometimes we can be absolutely astounded at the miscommunication that has taken place, and that simple exercise of feeding back what we perceive that we have heard can in itself transform the communication process. When we listen, we need to show interest in some nonverbal ways, like putting down the newspaper, or turning off the television set, or looking the other person in the eye, avoiding prior judgment or a condescending tone of voice or a negative facial expression. You see, when we listen to another person, we need to listen with a whole body, with an intensity that says, I'm focusing in upon you. Well, one of the wonderful things about God is, that's the way I perceive he listens to all of us when we pray. So at the same moment, every one of us can be talking to God, and he can listen to every one of us as if giving us his undivided attention. But we as mortals and with our finite nature, we can't do that. And so if we're really serious about listening to someone else, we need to shut off the other things and the other communications long enough to focus in. I doubt that it's possible to overestimate the power of listening. It's a principle that applies to our jobs and to our homes, to every possible relationship. And I'll tell you, you can revolutionize a marriage. And you can improve dramatically a friendship, and you can alter a parent-child relationship just by listening, really listening. That may be new in the relationship, and it may not quickly be able to transform and to catch on. So it's not just in the midst of a crisis. It's listening and listening and listening and listening and listening. Respect. Listen. Forgive. You know well from other studies that we have shared in together that all of Christianity is based on forgiveness. It's a central doctrine to our relationship to God and a central doctrine in our relationship to one another. That God has forgiven us, and so we are to forgive each other. I believe that introducing forgiveness into the dynamics of family communication can have a powerful, powerful potential. It can be one of our greatest opportunities to demonstrate Christ-likeness within a family context. That begins by asking for forgiveness. One of the things that is hard for people is to grow up in families where parents and others in authority never admitted that they ever did anything wrong. And some people are that way in marriages as well. Never admit being wrong. And so the other person never learns how to admit being wrong and never learns how to ask for forgiveness. I think sometimes as parents, we criticize our children because they don't say, "I'm sorry," and don't admit that they're wrong. But sometimes they have grown up in homes where they never heard anyone do that, where they've never seen it done, because parents have not been heard saying to one another or to the children, "I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?" Ask forgiveness, and ask for forgiveness without adding an explanation. So many times we say things like, "I'm sorry that I yelled at you. But if you hadn't yelled at me in the first place, I wouldn't have yelled at you," which is a somewhat tainted apology. And there's some lack of seriousness to the seeking of forgiveness. Or even the adding of explanation to the point of saying, "I know that I treated you rotten, and I'm sorry I treated you rotten, but I've had a rotten day." As if having a rotten day is an adequate excuse for treating anyone that way. We ought to ask forgiveness of one another simply saying, "I was wrong. I'm sorry." And when that is introduced into a family, introduced into a relationship, it ricochets throughout all of the communication and all of the relationship and can be extraordinary, can be transforming. The flip side of that is to not only ask for forgiveness, but to give forgiveness. Charlene and I play a communication game that we really should quit. I'm going to have to ask her to forgive me afterwards for communicating to her so publicly here, but there have been numerous times when we have asked one another for forgiveness, and the conversation goes something like this. I'll say, "I'm sorry, I really shouldn't. Will you forgive me?" And she says, "There's nothing to forgive." And I say, "Oh, yes, there really is." And she says, "No, there really isn't. You don't have to say you're sorry. You know, it's my fault." And I say, "No, it's my fault." And it's not just that way. We do it back and forth. We have rehearsed this for 25 years, so we're just really very good at that. And one of the things that we need to do, and I suggest that we all need to do, is when someone asks for forgiveness, give that forgiveness. Give that forgiveness and don't carry the consequences of it. I think I mentioned once before at Wooddale that when I was a teenager, one day I took out my father's new red convertible, and a friend of mine had said that you couldn't maintain 35 miles an hour on a certain mountain road. It turns out he was right, actually. And I attempted going the speed limit, not over it, but maintaining the speed limit on this curvy road, and I was unable to stay in my lane. I not only wrecked my father's car, but I wrecked the other car that was in the lane it was supposed to be in. And you know, I was frightened. I was dismayed. Calling my father was not one of the easier things that I've done. And he came with the other family car. And I said, "I'm sorry." And I tell you, I was sorry. And he said that he forgave me. And he said, "Leith, you just take the other car, the Volkswagen, and you just go ahead to where you're going, and and I'll take care of it. And, you know, that was the better part of a lifetime ago, but he has never once mentioned that to me again. That was a powerful influence in my life, that he really forgave me. I think sometimes in family situations, someone will do something and will admit that we're wrong and will say, "You're forgiven." But then a week later or a month later, the question comes up, "May I use the car?" And the cutting remark is, "Are you going to wreck this one too?" And so there really hasn't been forgiveness. Or if there has been forgiveness, it really hasn't been forgotten. Lack of forgiveness can be a terrible thing. And the giving of forgiveness can be a wonderful thing. I suppose that the lack of forgiveness is primarily hanging on to anger. And that's destructive to families. But it's also displeasing to God. It's an intriguing verse in James 1:20 that says, "The anger of man does not work the righteousness of God." Isn't that an interesting statement? The anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. Again, not that anger ought to be reckoned as always inappropriate, for often it's either appropriate or simply a reality. But it's what we do with that anger and holding on to it to the point that we do not forgive and we do not forget does not work the righteousness of God. Respect, listen, forgive, and last of all, initiate. You see, someone has got to get all of these things going. I would say, let it be you. Don't expect the wife or husband or parents or children to take the initiative. Heard one example of a wife who felt that the communication between herself and her husband had deteriorated and nothing that she did seemed to get his attention. So she went to the company, which he owned, went to the personnel department and applied for a job and got a job working in his office so that she could find some time with him and make an appointment with him. Now, I'm not suggesting that you go to quite that extent, but there are some practical things that you can do. There is a lady whose name is Margaret Campbell who writes in Marriage and Family Living some what I think are marvelous suggestions. She suggests that you set aside a special time to be with the person in your family that you want to communicate with. That's great. I find that I can make enough appointments to book up my schedule absolutely full all the time. I have appointments that are now set and dates that are committed well into 1989. And life can just go on like that until there's no time for family and there's no time for marriage or for communication. So one of the things that I have to do is I have to take my appointment book and I write down the times and the days and the occasions so that I'm absolutely assured that all of these other things will not encroach upon that family communication that is so necessary. It may be a couple that agrees that they're going to have dinner together once a week or once a month, or parents and children that go out for breakfast periodically, but making that time. Another practical idea is to think up ways, if you're going to take the initiative of having conversation leaders, perhaps things like reading in the newspaper and saying to husband or wife or to parents or children, "Did you read such and such an article about what happened to this person there in Minneapolis or St. Paul or Chicago or San Francisco? Did anything like that ever happen to you?" As Mrs. Campbell tells about watching a TV commercial on things that go bump in the night. And she turned to her husband and said, "Were you ever afraid of something that happened in the dark?" And although they had long been married, that initiated a conversation that gave him the opportunity to tell a great deal about his own background and his own childhood and about the things that had frightened him, things that otherwise they never would have communicated about. Really want to be practical? Then at home, ask questions like, "Have you ever been punished for something that you didn't do?" Let me just suggest that parents not change that question to ask, "Is there anything you ever did for which you should have been punished and haven't?" Now, that would be not fair in the communication process. Or to husband and wife, questions like, did you ever play hooky or get lost or get caught in a blizzard or have an unusual pet or run away from home or forget your part in a play? Or what was your most embarrassing moment or what was your favorite toy? Those simple types of initiative can take a deteriorated communication process and begin to heal it and begin to open it up. Another suggestion is to give affirmation, to find those things in someone else's life, and it's a principle that applies to everywhere, and say, you know, you're really good at this. I love the twinkle that you have in your eye, or I think that you're a marvelous cook, or it's delightful to have you around, or you sure handled that situation well. No one ever gets bored when complimented. No one ever gets bored when affirmed. Now, you may think all of this, at least of late, is rather shallow. And you may want to say, you know, hey, in our family, we're struggling with some really heavy, heavy issues. And you're talking about, what's a favorite toy? Or were you scared of something when you were a kid? Or did you forget a line in a play? We're interested in more serious things, not this kind of shallow stuff. Perhaps. Perhaps not. For in many families, the communication channels become so terribly clogged that the communication has to be reopened with things that are simple, that are easy. Often we need to begin by communicating as persons rather than focusing on the heavy-duty issues, so that at least we set up the system and begin then to be able to resolve the issues that have emerged from poor communication. I think that good communication is something like riding a bike. When you first do it, you think you'll never get the hang of it, and you fall and you skin your knee and you wobble back and forth. But once you get that part of it, then you're ready to ride around the block, and once you've ridden around the block, then you're ready to go medium distances, and maybe then eventually you're willing to take a cross-country tour. But you don't start there. You start with that which is simple, where you can take the initiative. Next to my office desk down the hall, I have a CPT 8000 word processor that has over recent years become, if you understand this, a dear friend, an old friend. It was serviced earlier this year, and the serviceman from CPT came and was rather incredulous. He said to me, do you know what the serial number is of this word processor? I said, no, what is it? He said, 6. I think he thinks it ought to be in the Smithsonian. Well, when I'm typing away and when I've finished a page, you know, I then go through the various commands and I transfer what I've got on the page to a disk. I try to do it before I lose it or before it locks up, and some of those things have in fact happened. And then I punch in the instructions for printing on that particular computer. You push code and punch, and then up on the screen come these different choices that you have to make on the size of the margins and the length of the page. And I put all of that together, and then I punch in the page from the disk that is to be printed, and then hit return. Now, often when I do this, in fact, it's happened this afternoon, I typed something in, and it happened today, it goes beep, talks to me, and then it signals a message that goes across the screen. The messages are like these. 8.51, the printer seems to be off. I usually can tell that without them telling me. And then it goes beep, the printer seems to be off. Beep, the printer seems to be off, and keeps repeating the message. Or 8.52, the printer needs more paper. Or 8.53, the printer needs a new ribbon. Or 8.54, the printer is reporting problems. Rather vague. Or 8.58, the printer does not respond. Or 8.59, which I have never fully understood, the printer is waiting. Now, all of this is a matter of communication. What I must do is learn to read the message and then to take the initiative to change the situation. The communication is there. There's something wrong. I have to read what's being communicated, and I have to take the initiative, and I have to fix it. Now, if I can't fix it, then I have to call in professional help from the outside. But I can't just let it go. I have to do something about it. All of which seems to me to be quite similar to family communication, that system messages are being sent out all the time, and that each one of us must take on something of an individual responsibility to read those messages and then make an effort to respond. And if we need outside help, if we can't handle it, then we get professional help. But we do what needs to be done so that the need can be met. Let's stand and pray together. Our Father, every single one of us comes from a family, and every one of us is concerned about that communication. If things are going well, then that gives to us almost a bliss that can strengthen us for all of the other battles and issues of life. But oh, as we so very well know, if the communication is awry at home, then it taints all the rest of life. It becomes difficult to cope, even if externally all the circumstances otherwise are okay. Lord, I pray that you will take the things about which we have talked tonight, that you will imprint them upon the disks of our minds, that we may call them up often, and that we may get into the practice of respecting one another in the communication process, of listening as we have never listened before, of forgiving and creating forgiveness that ricochets through our relationships, and of taking the initiative, that we may communicate one another and demonstrate Christ-likeness in the realities of the families in which we live. For we know that through that we shall benefit and grow, and in that you shall have glory and delight. Lord, bless these families here represented tonight, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Good night. God bless.